Apa kabar? Hello again, everyone. This is the Product Uncensored Show with Colin Pell. We are at episode 14, and for those of you who've been following us all the way from the start, thank you so much. If any of you, whether you've been following from the first episode or not, have any feedback, or if you have any guests you'd like to see on the show, please feel free to send it my way. All interaction is always welcome. Do support the show by liking, subscribing, following. If you're subscribing on YouTube, please also click on the notification bell so you will get instant notifications when new content comes out. We are also available on all major podcasting platforms, so it should be coming out here somewhere. Now, let's talk about today's guest. I'm excited for today's show for a couple of reasons. I think the first one is that it's been a while since we had a female product leader on the show. So I'm really happy that she's able to make it. And by the way, it's not for lack of trying. I have a feeling that, you know, maybe it's my face or something, but I haven't, a few of the female leaders that I've tried to get, you know, have very politely turned me down. So yes, I will keep trying. But yes, we have one more leader on the show today. And secondly, also, because this has been a long time coming, we've tried really hard to get this to finally work. So I'm super excited to have the SVP of Product Management for Gojek on our show. Welcome to the show, Bak Dian, right?
Yes, correct. Thank you for having me.
Yes. So I learned something very new today. So So Bak apparently is how you would refer to someone who's a peer or a friend, I guess. For the feminine version to Mas. If you guys are not from Indonesia, go learn some Indonesian slang. It's quite fun. So thank you so much for being on the show, Dian. And also want to thank Gojek as well for allowing her to get on the show. Really had to clear a few hurdles so that, you know, we would, you know, get this to work. And also Dian is joining us all the way from the US. So it's actually nighttime her time. So super effort on her part. Thank you so much. All right. So Dian, let's start with a little bit about yourself. You are Indonesian.
Yep.
So tell us the story about, you know, where you grew up and how did you end up in the States?
Yeah, of course. Born and raised in Jakarta. So I was there all through high school. I think, you know, I've always wanted to study and live abroad, even as like a young child. So I think eventually, you know, moving somewhere outside of Indonesia to pursue education was a very natural choice for me. I think I applied to like 14 or 15 schools in the US or Canada to make sure, you know, I could like go out there and experience something new. I left for the States after taking a gap year between high school and university. I actually spent some time in China that first year to study Mandarin. And then I moved to the Bay Area for university and I've been there for almost 15 years now. The years just fly by.
So yeah, you're saying that you applied to US and Canada as well. Which was actually your preference, US or Canada? Or you didn't care as long as they're far, far away?
No, I didn't really care. I think for both I had family and people I knew there. Both, I think I had more family in Canada, but yeah, no preference.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about what you studied in university, because it's very interesting, right? You have a Bachelor of Science in Symbolic Systems and Human-Computer Interaction. That sounds like super meta, you know, so... Tell me more about it.
Oh gosh. Okay. My parents asked me this too. They're like, what are you studying again? I think all parents of, these students who end up in this program ask this question. I like to start with just, you know, the name Symbolic Systems. It's a good place to start. And then I can branch out into like what that actually means. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think they chose that name for the program because it's actually quite descriptive, right? Basically, this program studies systems that are built with symbols. So things like natural language, programming and computer science, right? Formal logic, right? And then also studies systems that actually work with symbols, like our brains, like computers, like social systems. And so this is a very interdisciplinary program that marries a lot of different disciplines. I think in some other schools, it's called cognitive science, which is, I think, okay, easier to understand.
Yes, somewhat. But,
yeah. So I think this allows like a lot of room to kind of like, you know, decide where you want to go with that. So for example, right, mine is on computer interaction, human-computer interaction. And I went heavy, I think, on like some design thinking and a little bit of computer science. And then you had like much more technical, I think, concentrations like AI. And then you had concentrations like cognitive science, where it was heavier, I think, on psychology and cognitive science and brain science. So yeah, it was a really fun program.
And how did you select that course? Like, did you know about it, or because you saw like, you know, symbolic, oh, you know, it sounds really cool, and then, you know, how did you choose?
I wish I found out about it sooner. So at Stanford, actually, they don't require you to declare your major until your third year. So I basically floundered and, you know, for the first couple of years trying to figure out what I wanted to study. I had your typical, I think, Asian traditional parents who really nudged me towards engineering. So I explored computer science for a little bit. And then, you know, a few classes in, like, they asked us to start writing assembly code. And I was like, okay, this really isn't for me. Like, tech and computer science is interesting, but I don't love it that much to just make this the only thing I study. I looked, I think, at management science and engineering. So like operations engineering, because I thought that would be practical. But it was a little too just dry for me. And then I was, I think, chatting with somebody on like the balcony of my dorm, a good friend of mine who basically had just gone through the exact same journey as me, a very similar journey of like trying to find out like what he wanted to do and try to marry all these different interests, and told me, you really should look into symbolic systems. I think this is what you're looking for. And it's quite a small program, but some pretty impressive alumni once I looked into it. So Marissa Meyer, of Google and Yahoo fame, was a SimSys major. Right. Mike Krieger, co-founder of Instagram, actually was my TA in the SimSys program. So I was like, okay, like people who like took this program, like find their passion and are doing well. So let's do this.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So then let's rewind a little bit to you made this comment that I really am very curious now. You said that when I asked you the question about your major, you said your mom asked you the same question, right? Was it because like she just couldn't understand what you were studying? Like, am I paying for this education, which I have no idea what the output is? Like, was it a typical Asian parent response?
I think so. I think she was concerned. She was like, are you sure this is like an actual thing, or are you making this up? Like, is this a real program? It should be okay, mom. Like, I'm studying computer science as part of it, but also design was kind of how I described it to her.
Okay. Did the computer science part sort of placate her a little bit, like, you know, give her a bit more comfort?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Fantastic. Because I had to do the same thing with mine as well. You know, my parents wanted me to do engineering. Obviously, I didn't want to. So I pulled out the same cards, like, hey, you know, I'm doing IT, you know, computer science, you know, it's technical. It's just not engineering. So, so lots of similarities there. Okay. Yeah. So then after you finished studying, you actually went into data, right? You were a data consultant, and then you were a data curator at Unoodle and Quid. Was that by accident, or did you want to go into a data role purposefully?
I think a bit of both, to be honest. Like, I had an inkling of what I wanted to do, and I knew I wanted to do something in tech and stay in the Bay Area. And I knew that I wanted to have something to do with product design, or like designing products, building things for customers, right? I didn't really have product management as a label in my, you know, in that dictionary of careers.
But so, did you know about product management at that time already?
No. So like when I graduated and I joined Unoodle, which spun out Quid, I didn't really know about product management. I knew product design existed, but not product management as a discipline or a career. So I think I basically just, you know, I met, you know, the founders of the startup. They said they needed somebody to kind of be a generalist, like look at data, look at product design. I was like, I'm your person. Just take me so I can learn. And that's where I actually learned about, you know, the existence of like product management as a discipline. Like they had a senior product designer and a product management lead. And so I just shadowed him a lot.
Okay.
And figured out, you know, how it all worked.
Okay. So then let's move on to how you got your first gig into product management. It was for Flipboard, right? How did that happen when you were doing data for Unoodle and Quid?
I'm going to have to thank my network for that, I would say. This was through, I think, a contact through my Stanford network, and she found out what I was doing at Quid and Unoodle and said like, hey, we're actually looking for somebody, you know, to kind of do this at Flipboard. And you know, this would be in product, you'd be a product manager. That's basically what you're doing right now. And I was employee number 25 or 26. So it was quite small when I joined. It was just me and this other person who was the product lead there.
Yeah. Right.
That's how it happened.
So tell me a little bit more. I mean, this is contextualized to obviously your time at the Bay Area, because product management, especially when you're in the Bay Area, everything is ultra competitive in the tech scene. And I'm guessing that product management is no different, right? So how did you sort of edge out, you know, other candidates or rather, well, you won't know that, but rather like, what do you think made you different that, you know, you would get accepted as a product manager? Was it purely the connection like you were mentioning, or was it something else that you learned in your time as a data consultant?
Yeah, I think if I look back on that time, I think it was, I'm not gonna say that it was all me, right? I think it's a combination, I think, of luck. The company was pretty early stage at the time. So I think they weren't looking for something super specific, right? Mm-hmm. They were looking for a generalist, somebody who understood data, somebody who understood design and product and tech, and somebody who was willing to kind of wear many hats. And I think I had that at the time, right? I was very early in my career. I was like, just throw whatever you want at me. I'll do it and make it happen, right? And like, I do know, you know, I know how to handle data. I know how to like handle, you know, I know how to work with engineers and designers. So I had that for me, but I didn't have a ton of experience. So I think it was just like a lot of grit and gusto.
Okay, very nice. interesting trivia. I still use Flipboard today. It's actually my, yeah.
Wow.
I use Flipboard and two other apps for news and information. Still like it
very
a lot.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very
so.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. And so you spent a good 3 years there. And since I still use Flipboard, so here's the question for you. What is the proudest feature or thing that you did for Flipboard in your time at Flipboard?
Oh gosh, it's not even really a feature. It was like, I think something that I pulled off that I'm really proud of. But if you remember way back when, you know, we weren't available in all the languages, right? We hadn't internationalized and localized. And I think I got a mandate to localize our Android app into 11 languages in a mere couple of weeks to make a launch and to kind of meet a business deal. And I made that happen.
Wow.
I think that was a really, really fun exercise in like understanding like, you know, how the inner workings of the app also work, right? Like how do you get an app localized, right? And how do you bring people together? How do you, you know, test all of these different things to make sure that they actually don't break the UI? What are the tools that are available to do this? And I was able to really get into the trenches, work with engineering, QA, design, a bunch of local translators. So that was really fun.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. Very interesting. I like that. Then let's move on to the next role, because you then moved to change.org. And again, you know, this is you've got very interesting roles in very interesting companies, right? Tell us more about that role in change.org, because I think at the time that you were there, they hadn't gotten the funding from Reid Hoffman yet. They changed their model. So at the time you were there, they were still would they be considered a nonprofit at that time?
No, I think they were never a nonprofit. They were always a B Corp, but I think the model was is quite different than it was post that funding.
Yeah. Okay. And so how different was that role, being a product manager in a B Corp type company? So for those on the show, a B Corp type company is, well, maybe you should explain what a B Corp company is.
Well, I think it's a certification for companies basically who are for-profit companies. But they go through a certification process basically that that basically validates that they are a social good enterprise or a social good company.
Yes. So no, good thing I asked you to explain. It's a lot better from you. So yes, was it different? Yeah. Your role there working for a company like Change.org?
I think it was, I don't know. It was different in that I think the product culture was quite different between Flipboard and Change.org. I think the way I've described it to other people is that at Flipboard, we were very, I think, design-driven, and I think visual design mattered a lot, right?
Yes.
I mean, you can tell from the product. And at Change.org, I think we were quite a bit more data-driven than Flipboard, and didn't spend as much time paying attention to those visual details. And I think I kind of learned the pros and cons of both, right, and operating both ways. Where at Flipboard, I wish we had like used more data to inform some of our decisions. At Change.org, I wish, you know, we didn't, you know, use less data to inform certain decisions and actually thought about what the customer needed. And so I think I was able to kind of refine like my point of view through
okay.
that process.
Do you feel like, listening to what you said about Change.org, would you classify them as a company that is data driven, like very data driven?
When I was there, I would say so. Yeah. We I think the PMs there, myself included, we lived and breathed like mixed panel and experiments and, you know, looking at our funnels every day. We thought about how to, you know, move certain metrics, and sometimes at the cost of, you know, our customer experience. I think I've made a couple of decisions where we ended up sending even more emails to customers. Looking back, I was like, we probably didn't need to, but then those brought in like the numbers and the clicks and the conversions we wanted to see in the data, right? Mm-hmm. But overall, I think that contributed to a poorer customer experience in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I would ask this question now, even though I kind of was thinking of asking it a little bit later. And this isn't specific to Change.org, but speaking about companies that are very data driven, and as what you mentioned, how do you think product managers or product leaders should balance that fine line, like you were mentioning, being data driven, but at the same time, not giving up, you know, the user experience such that, you know, it becomes really crappy.
Yeah. I think I've refined this a bit at Gojek and learned a little bit of this at Gojek and my previous company is one, I think having strong principles around what to do and what not to do. Right. When you're thinking about what you're building for your customers, for example, I think one we're actually introducing, you know, company-wide product principles for the first time in the next few weeks, actually, where I'm refining some copy. But for example, you know, one of the principles is something like, you know, we value our customers' time, or we don't waste our customers' time. So when you think about what you're doing, we're thinking about how do we build frictionless experiences, right? That matters. That should be front of mind. How do we, you know, avoid engaging our customers for the sake of engagement, you know, because we don't want to distract them, right? We actually want them to come in and like get what they want to do done and not distract them from like what actually matters. So things like that, I think, are really important. So like when you have product principles or like any kind of principles and values front and center, I think they help guide you decision making. And then two, I think if you find yourself in a really, I think, quantitative environment, which I think Gojek is pretty, you know, a pretty quant-driven, I think, product environment, Thinking about how do you actually quantify some customer experiences, right? Mm-hmm. How do you measure that? I'm in the middle of doing that right now. How do we quantify that a little better? How do we tie that to like metrics that people are maybe more familiar with already, right? Like conversions, other business metrics. And can we correlate that, right? And sometimes, you know, I hope that I only have to do this a few times and kind of show that there is value and not have to keep correlating that, because mm-hmm. there is value, right? And like making sure that we're paying attention to the customer experience.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
It does. It does. If we have time, I'll probably round back to that, because I have a few more, you know, what you've mentioned has, you know, triggered some other questions. We'll come back to that. Yeah, because I want to get to the Gojek part, but before that, I also want to stop at Off-Grid Electric, where you were the senior product manager there.
Yeah.
And the reason why I'm very curious about this is you were managing the software part of Off-Grid Electric, but their primary market was Africa. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah.
And you were based off of the U.S.?
We had, our headquarters was in Arusha, Tanzania, and we had a small office for the hardware and software team in San Francisco, and we traveled a lot.
To Tanzania?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, so tell me a bit more about that. I'm always interested when, you know, there is a company where people work in the Bay Area, but the product is not in the Bay Area, because, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it was a very intentionally distributed, I think, company. And I think my time there has really helped me, like, be ready for the current environment that we're in. So I'll start with just, like, the team, right? So you had, a few PMs in San Francisco. We actually had, you know, the data team was actually in Arusha, Tanzania, with all the regional ops teams. Sales teams, you know, service teams. We had the hardware team in San Francisco. Our software engineers, none of them were in the San Francisco office. So my director of engineering, my peer was, he was in Colorado. We had a couple other engineers in Colorado. It's in a different state, right? A different time zone even. They're an hour ahead, I believe. And we had several engineers in Russia. We had engineers in Africa. In Washington, D.C., Pennsylvania. Wow. So it was very intentional, I think. I think before I joined, they had said, we're going to make this distributed and remote, and we're going to invest in making it work.
Mm-hmm. So here's the question that I'm very curious about, because usually for product managers, they tend to want them to be close to it's usually one extreme or the other, as in they want them to be very close to the business. So I want you to sit in the head office, right? So that's where all the big business decisions get made. Yeah. Or they tend to want them to sit very close to the engineering teams, especially if they're not in the same location. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But in your case, you were literally in the middle of everything, but not close enough to everything. How did you product manage, you know, engineers in different time zones, you know, your peers and your bosses in a different country and time zone as well?
I think we got really good at setting up the right communication structures and like the right cadences. So I had, you know, the software like PMs establish like a really strong relationship with the various operational and functional leads that sit in Africa, right? So for example, I was overseeing like the kind of all the software and services related to our service organization. So everything from like, you know, our tools for the call center, our app for our field service agents, that was like something I was looking at. I was also looking at the tools for like our last mile and logistics area. And so we had operational and business counterparts there. And so we had to like basically be, you know, joined at the hip, right? There's another product manager who's focusing more on like sales products, right? The apps for like the sales agents, thinking through like how these field agents are selling to customers and what we're building for them. He was attached to the hip to our like our sales leader in Tanzania. So and we did a lot of travel, right? We'd spend, you know, some of the PMs will spend like 6 months at a time there. I've been there for up to 3 months, brought my husband with me so that we could stay that long. And with engineering, I think with engineering, it's actually a little easier. I think it's harder to, I think, really understand and remember customer pain and what the challenges are, unless you are experiencing them or sitting next to a call center agent, kind of listening through some of the challenges. So for me, it was more important to focus on that side of things, and the engineering mm-hmm. pieces, we were able to manage pretty easily.
Okay. Yep. So yeah, I think the travel there for a prolonged period definitely helped to, bring up your understanding of the local scene. Mm-hmm. At mm-hmm. the same time as well, an appreciation for what you guys are doing as well, right? Seeing it on the yep. ground.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, but the question I forgot to ask you about Azolla Electric was, what made you join them?
A couple of different things. I think since change.org, I think I kind of said to myself, I made a personal commitment that any other company I joined after that needed to have some element of a social, mission. I needed to feel like I was contributing something that made the world a better place. And I was actually about to sign an offer with a different company where I was, I was excited about the team, and I was very excited about the product challenges, but it didn't really tick that box. So I was like, oh man, I'm about to go back on my own commitment. And then right before I signed that offer, a friend of a friend said, hey, this company is looking for someone that sounds exactly like you.
It's got your name on it.
It's like, you really should talk to the hiring manager. And I was literally I think on my way to Mexico for a vacation, took the first couple of phone screens over Zoom in Mexico. And then realized that I needed to explore this because of their mission and the impact they were having. And honestly, Thor, if you're listening, I really wanted to work for you. My boss and hiring manager was very inspiring. And I really wanted to work with him.
His name is Thor?
His name is Thor.
Damn. We need to talk about his hammer, man. So I'm sorry, but that was too good an opportunity to let up. Yeah, all right. So you were saying that, you wanted to sort of join companies with a sort of a mission that made it a better place. Mm-hmm. How did that lead from Azolla to then Gojek?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's Gojek. I think a clear social impact. It was also a deeply personal decision for me. I should start right because mm-hmm. I did want to be closer to my family in Indonesia. I really wanted to, experience, I think, what it was like to work at a tech company in my own home country. And before, I think before the last few years, there weren't really any opportunities to do that, right? And so the tech scene sort of started really growing the last few years. So I was excited to return and do that. But yeah, for Gojek, I think our impact isn't just on customers, right? When you think about the lives of the drivers and the merchants and the opportunities we unlock, the impact we've had on the Indonesian economy, the mission we have, I think, around financial inclusion, on our GoPay arm. When I spoke to the folks at Gojek, I think it was very clear that we weren't doing this just to make our customers' lives easier. We were doing this because we wanted to create an ecosystem where, we were unlocking new opportunities for, what tended to be the underdogs and people, who might be overlooked otherwise.
Okay. Very nice. And you said that it was a deeply personal decision because, you wanted to work in a tech company that was from your home country. And you're still in the US. So the curious question that I want to just clarify is the long-term plan for you to move back to Jakarta?
Yes, we've been actually, so since I joined Gojek in 2018, I've spent about half of my time in Jakarta and half my time in California, where my husband and my cat are. And we were actually making plans to be fully relocated to Jakarta, as of right now, before 2020 happened.
Yes, before this just small thing called COVID happened, right?
Yeah, so that was always the long-term plan. So it was you know, it was going to be a 1-2 year process to make sure that, you know, my husband could wrap up his work here before we relocated. So yeah, that is the plan.
Okay. And so when you moved to Gojek, let me pull it back maybe one step. How did Gojek get in touch with you? How did you get in touch with Gojek? And like who looked for who?
It was a bit of both. It goes back actually quite a few years. So I think starting 2008 or 2009, I started paying attention to what was happening in tech in Indonesia, right? And met a few people in the community, stayed in touch with them. Kevin, our co-CEO, actually, I knew him from, you know, through a different network. He was also in California, and many years before he became the co-founder and CEO of Gojek, he was not in tech, and he was actually looking to explore the tech scene in Indonesia before moving back there from California. So I made that connection and stayed in touch with him. I introduced him to some of like my community there in Indonesia who I knew. And then we stayed in touch when he kind of like, you know, started his journey with Gojek, and he had questions about, you know, what should I care about when I like, you know, structure like my product teams? Like, what do you think about this? Do you want to check out our app? What do you think? And we just kind of stayed in touch over the years until at one point they had really grown. And I was like, what am I doing? Why am I just like talking to them instead of actually trying to work for them? Right. So yeah, went through like the process of interviewing with Gojek and landed there in 2018. So it was like, I don't know if we just found each other a long time ago, maybe.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, at least you already had, you know, sort of had contact with them. You kept in touch. So it's not to say you came in totally clueless, right? So you already knew the co-founder anyway. Okay. And your role in Gojek is your first senior leadership role. How easy or difficult has that been, that transition? Because it's not just and I asked this of a lot of other people on the show as well, because in many cases most of you are not just going into a new role, it's also usually a new country. So I'm always curious to know, how easy or difficult was it?
It's one of the hardest things I've ever done. I'll be honest, like it's definitely a big stretch for me. It's the biggest team I've ever like worked with, biggest company I've ever worked with. I've never seen the scale before Gojek. Everything that I have solved before takes on a different flavor when you're trying to solve the same problem at the scale, right? And sometimes, you know, I ask myself and I ask Kevin, man, maybe I should have like joined a couple years earlier when, you know, we have the same similar problems, but at a much smaller scale, I would have been able to solve it quicker, right? The scale changes everything, I think, because we have, when I joined, it was 80 PMs, I think, and now we're 130, 140 product managers. It's big.
I know, it's crazy. I mean, just hearing that number, 130 product managers, it's insane. That it's bigger than some companies. So. Yeah. So what were the most difficult parts of what you had to learn? Because like you're saying, it was a stretch, but if you can tell us a little bit more about what were the things that you really had to like learn on the fly? Like what did you have to, you know, hit the ground running doing, and what were the things that you had to, oh my gosh, I can't do this anymore. I have to start doing this.
I think one of the hardest things for me is actually feeling like I couldn't have as much direct impact on like products, right? I was like a few layers removed and really focused on the organization for the first like year and a half. We had to put in a lot of structures around how do we hire product managers, right? That had not been set in place when I joined. How do we evaluate product managers? What is the JD for product managers? That is still evolving, I think, even today, right? I think if you ask any product leader, that continues to evolve. So I think spending a lot of time doing that and feeling a little like removed from the actual product and the actual customers was one of the harder things for me. Did
you get withdrawal symptoms?
A little bit. I got withdrawal. I got a bit of FOMO. I got a bit of like imposter syndrome. I was like, is this the right thing to be focusing on? Like, I feel like I'm not doing anything for the customer right now. Right. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. Is this the right thing? Thankfully, I think, you know, now that that's a bit more settled, I can actually, so like my focus right now is product operations. Right. And I think it is, it fits well with like my current location and being stuck in California, because, you know, being at a different time zone, this type of work, I think, is a bit more forgiving for the time zone and being 15 hours behind everybody else. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But thinking about how do we become more customer centric as a company, right? What are some of the frameworks and principles we want to operate by? And so thinking about that at scale, and knowing that maybe I'm not directly impacting any one product, but like, how do I actually, you know, help steer the organization towards that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wow, very, very insightful. And so moving in that same direction, right? Yeah. What did you do to sort of sense check yourself in that sense? Like, because you were saying the imposter syndrome, asking the question, is this the right thing? What did you do or how did you manage that to know that, you know, was it just jump and hope it all, you know, works? Or I've read, you know, Marty Kagan said 1, 2, 3, I'm doing 1, 2, 3, right? So.
Great question. I think I kind of treated like the product management org like a product, right? Like I was PMing the PM org, so to speak. So I had to make sure I had like OKRs and like some metrics, you know, quantitative metrics, qualitative metrics. I measured, you know, we've had an ongoing survey since, you know, since I joined that we've been sending the team. And so we check on, you know, it's kind of like a more specific kind of like employee engagement survey that's specifically for like product manager problems, right? So like, do you feel that you actually understand your role? Do you feel that like your work, you feel connected to the company vision? You understand how your product is contributing? Questions like that, right? And kind of tracking the trend over time. And we're trending positively. So I think we're doing something right.
Well, you must be.
There's still a lot, I think, to solve. But I think, you know, I think we're on the right track.
Nice. And also, again, you know, I'm going to have to really keep pushing a little bit more about this, because I think that's the really interesting part about your career. When you decided to join Gojek, was it like, did you fly back to Indonesia to, you know, to get unveiled in that sense? And also, sounds a little bit strange, but anyway, how did you build up the credibility, right? Because you when you joined, you said they were like what, 80 product managers? Mm-hmm. And so they're probably trying to figure out who you are, you're trying to figure out who they are, you know, how do you say that, you know, hey, I'm kind of the person leading the team, but at the same time, you don't want to do it like, you know, like a draconian Nazi dictator, right? So
yeah,
I guess
I'll just take it from like your typical product manager playbook again, which is to like try to actually solve the customer's problem, right? And treating like the organization like a customer and not jumping to solutions, but really spending time to discover what are the problems and the pain points. I think my first two months or so, 3 months even, was just a lot of listening and meeting. And collecting data, getting that baseline survey out, spending a lot of one-on-one time with people, you know, not just PMs, but like our stakeholders, you know, designers, researchers, engineers. And that was, you know, that led to kind of prioritizing the two areas that we did for the first like 6 to 12 months. Like, how do we make sure that PMs feel like they have a career path that have some clarity in their job description? Mm-hmm. And how do we make sure that we are hiring the right people and have like a standard for hiring, right? Because that didn't exist at the time. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what about cultural differences between, you know, what you were doing, because obviously you were working for, well, technically Off-Grid was Tanzania based, but anyway, the culture when you went, when you joined Gojek, how different was it? How difficult was it to adjust as
I think there was definitely a bit of an adjustment. First of all, something really simple. I hadn't been speaking Indonesian day to day for a really long time. I mean, it's my first language, but when I landed there and like I was trying to like give like a Gojek driver directions to my mom's house, the house I grew up in, and like I couldn't, I was like fumbling with my words and I was like, what's happening? I've lost my vocabulary. So I think that took some time to get used to, just being able to actually feel like I could credibly speak in a professional setting in my own language. And then I think really balancing, you know, I had gotten used to just being like extremely candid in public forums, right? And really kind of checking myself and kind of checking, okay, like, is this an, like, are, you know, is this something that we are used to as an organization yet? Or like, do we still prefer to discuss certain things, you know, more privately? There are some cultural nuances and religious, I think, nuances of, you know, like, some people will not want to shake hands with me, for example, right? Because I'm a woman. And like, I had a very awkward moment with somebody where I was like, kind of just shoving my hand in there in front of them. I was like, oh, you really don't want to shake my hand. And you don't really want to decline. You don't want to decline that either, because you don't want to seem impolite. So I think, you know, those, you know, nuances I had to like get used to again. But overall, it wasn't a very hard adjustment.
Okay, so from a cultural perspective, it was a lot easier. It sounds like you had to sort of rediscover where, you know, the nuances of growing up in Indonesia.
Yeah, it helps. I think it really helps a lot that I grew up there and I speak the language.
Yeah. And this is just a very curious question. For those of you who watched the other, in the, some of the other episodes, I also interviewed the VP of product for Bukalapak. And it was very interesting to hear Hendro's story about how he had to sort of bridge the language barrier. It was one of the things that he highlighted as something tough. And so the curious question for you is, did you have to also sort of learn Bahasa Indonesia now as the primary language of communication with people, not just officially, but even in day-to-day interaction with your team?
Day-to-day interaction is a lot easier for me. I think what I had to kind of learn a little bit more was, you know, when like speaking in public in Indonesian or just speaking in a more like professional setting. Like I didn't, you know, this was something I'd never done before, right? This is my first job in Indonesia. That said, I think it's a little bit easier for me than it was for Hendro, probably because half of our product and engineering teams are in Bangalore, India. Okay. And we have a team also in Singapore. So I think as a whole, like at least all the product and tech teams, we have to use English, you know, when we're kind of interacting across offices, because that is the unifying language. So, but as soon as I'm in a meeting with only Indonesians, I, you know, we switch back to Indonesian, and I'm comfortable doing that now, thankfully.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned something about, you know, cultural nuances, and then suddenly I'm triggered to ask as well. How do you think perception was for someone like you, and I'll qualify what I mean by someone like you in a bit, because I know it sounds weird, when you went back there? Because obviously, like, so context, like you're the kind of person, I think, who wears her heart on a sleeve, right? You know, I can see your tats, you know, you, every time I see you, your hair is a different color. And, you know, back, I mean, I'm sure in the States, nobody bats an eyelid, right? But you're going back to Indonesia where, like you just mentioned, right, there's some nuances, you know, like even simple things that we take for granted, like shaking hands. It's not that easy, right? Mm-hmm. Do you think that actually had an impact for you? Did you find that you had to, change a little bit? Or was it just waiting for time to normalize?
That's a good question. It might be that I'm like not as sensitive to that, if like that got in my way, or like I think definitely, you know, having my hair colored and like having tattoos would draw some stares. And I don't know if like I'm always maybe taken seriously in certain contexts, right? So I do wonder about that sometimes. But overall, I think the culture has been like pretty accepting of that. You know, I don't think it's gotten in my way of like getting things done or like any perception of me. I hope not. I really hope not.
Well, if you've not felt it, then I'm guessing it's been good so far, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a pretty progressive, I think, company overall. And like, you know, I'm always professional and I think my work speaks for itself. So I was like, yeah, I have tattoos and some of them are actually like ugly and I don't like them. But here we are.
It's time to ink over. It's time to ink over. Put the Gojek logo there and you'll be fine.
I mean, I love Gojek. I don't know if, you know, I love it that much.
Yeah. All right. And so if, let's say people on the show are listening and are watching and they're trying or they're in the process of becoming product leaders themselves, you know, joining the biggest company they've ever joined, biggest product team they've ever led, what will be your advice for them to do it well?
Well, you're not alone. And I know probably a lot of people will say, find yourself like a mentor or somebody who knows what you're going through. But actually, I think what really helped me is find a couple of people you can really trust to help you execute on your vision, right? Like if you were to find an extension of yourself, right? And you wanted somebody, a partner to execute on what you wanted to do at an unfamiliar place, you want to make sure that you either like find somebody you already trust or like quickly find somebody at the company, form that trust and execute together. So an execution partner, I think, is pretty critical. And I was able to do that at Gojek and I'm very thankful for those folks.
Okay. So just make sure you find two lieutenants and then you're good to go.
It helps a lot.
Okay. And also now in your, because you've been with Gojek since 2018, you've obviously grown with the company along with the team size and things like that. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that, you know, Gojek has offices in India, in Singapore. There's one other location that Gojek has offices in, right? But I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, India, I think we have like a second office in Gurgaon. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Near Delhi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's obviously three different locations. And like you were saying, right, it hasn't really hampered communication, delivery, creating value too much because you've put in processes in place. And I believe your talk during the MTP as well touched on that, which, by the way, was a really good talk. So the question that I'm thinking is for the future of product management. Well, maybe let's zoom it into maybe Southeast Asia, products that are based in Southeast Asia or Asia for that matter, right? Do you think we could go fully remote? Because now you've really got offices all over the place and remote is literally just one step further. You've done it with off-grid. You know, what are your thoughts on that?
I think my thoughts will reflect what I mentioned to you earlier, which is I think the trick is to, you know, figure out a way that your builders are still, you know, in touch with like the customers, right? Mm-hmm. So either through making sure that they have some, you know, physical touch points, right, to that experience, or having a very robust processes to make sure that empathy isn't lost when you're not there. And we don't have that perfect yet here at Gojek, but we really strive to kind of do that because, you know, we know that like half of our builders are in a different market and can't use our product every day, right?
Yeah.
So all of our researchers, for example, are in market, right? None of them are actually in India.
Yeah.
And that, I think, you know, making sure that you have kind of that that you maintain that connection and figure out how do you scale that empathy, I think is really important. But otherwise, I think, you know, one can work from anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but if let's say we, let's use the example of, let's say, off-grid as the, the reference point, right? The time zone differences is usually the factor that a lot of people say why product managers can't work remotely, because obviously the overheads of communication and things like that are very high. And yet your experience in off-grid and a lot of other people, a growing number of people have also proven that you can do it remotely even with time zone differences. And probably, I guess now would be even better because now you're in California and obviously, you know, Gojek is in Jakarta, right? In that sense. So how would you say, you know, product managers in these kinds of scenarios get better at what they're doing without sacrificing too much of the quality of being in person?
I'm trying to like draw on specific things that I do. I think you have to get really good at asynchronous communications. I think that was one of the first things I had to just get used to mentally also. You know, from change.org, I could just kind of turn around and talk to my tech lead, you know, to kind of problem solve something. And I couldn't, like, and if I didn't have my stuff together, you know, that meant we lost like, you know, 11 to 15 hours before I got my answer, right? So I think being a lot more intentional about how you want to spend your time and prioritize like your tasks and in what order you need to kind of prep them so that you can have them, like if you need feedback from somebody that's in a different time zone, being very specific about like what you need, making sure you have everything prepped so that when you kind of dump it on their plate and you go to bed for 8 hours, that they have everything that they need to kind of give you the feedback or deliverable that you're asking for, right? So I think that's probably one of the things that I really have refined over the last couple of years in terms of ways of working, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So let's talk about the getting better at asynchronous communication, because usually that's the priority numero uno. Do you have any tips on what anyone can do or any product leader or team to get better at asynchronous communication? Any specific things that you do that, you know, works?
I can start with tools. We live and die by Asana here at Gojek. You know, everything that requires like attention or a deliverable or an update is now like migrating to Asana. And so having like a shared tool is really helpful. I think clear roles and decision makers on any kind of discussion or question is really important. So instead of, you know, when you're async and you're not sure like what the decision tree is and who the final decision maker is, then that has the potential to just kind of go on for a really long time. Whereas if you're clear, okay, for this decision, here's who we need to, like for any decision in this project, for example, here are the people you need to like involve. Here's the person who's accountable for like driving decisions. When we get stuck, here's the person who has a final say and has veto rights. And like, here are the people you should consult. And here are the people who don't need to be consulted, but you should probably just like inform as key decisions arise. We call that I think we use the Darcy model. Use like Racy. So I think that's been really important in a lot of our asynchronous discussions.
Okay, fantastic. I'm going to ask you a very, this is another one of those questions that I've wanted to ask you, and now suddenly they mentioned it, I can ask you. You were saying that, you know, everyone in Gojek is moving to Asana.
Yeah.
And obviously Jira is the darling in this space. Why didn't you use Jira instead of Asana?
Ah, we're still using both. Yay. Got you there. Everything that has to do, I think, with software development still lives in Jira. But like for us to like manage all of our non-technical stakeholders, we use Asana. So all our program managers use that when we want to communicate, like, you know, with business stakeholders. We use Asana. Those are, you know, tied to specific Jira epics where necessary, so that, you know, they're integrated. So we use both. We did not get rid of Jira.
Okay. So I like how much glee you said. Oh, yes, we're still getting Jira. So Yeah. So Asana for like, is it like, would I say company wide?
We're getting there. Yeah.
Okay. And Jira is for tech.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. And what is the thinking around, you know, why not stick with Jira and, you know, just use it? Because obviously Jira has tools even mm-hmm. for, you know, decision making, mm-hmm. Presenting to non-technical stakeholders.
Yeah.
La-di-da. Yeah.
Definitely. There's a couple of like program managers assigned to this because it's, you know, an epic effort to kind of standardize a company mm-hmm, of mm-hmm. this size to two tools when we have
dozens
that everybody was using. We were using like Favro and Trello and Reich and everything. So there was a process by which we decided this is why we're going to select these two. And I think for like, I'm not speaking for everybody, but for mm-hmm. me, Jira, I think is highly configurable.
Yes.
But I think has a lot of like upfront costs for configuring the right thing. And yeah. for most of the company and most of our needs, we just needed, you know, a lighter collaboration tool mm. and Asana mm. met those needs.
Yeah. And I think Asana has that portfolio vertical view that is quite cool as well, right? So.
Yep. We use that for our OKRs now. We even use Asana for our meeting logs, you know, because instead of recording like your one-on-one notes or your team meeting notes in a Google Doc, for example, you do that in Asana. We have like, we set up the agenda and the queue in there. We pull them into, you know, sections. And then as you come up with action items, you just assign them in line, which is, and you can see them all in context, which is pretty great.
Yeah, that's a really good tip, I think. I can still remember, you know, the difficulties of having, you know, Jira and then Google Docs and, you know, just trying to mishmash between the two and then people yeah. using Evernote and sharing it across the
earth. Oh no.
Yeah, all
cringing.
The... But we'll leave that for now. Let sleeping dogs lie. Okay. The next thing that I wanted to sort of explore with you a little bit is female leadership in Southeast Asia with regards mm-hmm. to product in specific, mainly yeah. because, again, it comes back to earlier we were talking about, you know, cultural nuances and differences. How easy or difficult has it been for you to settle down in your role as a product leader who is female mm-hmm. in Southeast mm-hmm. Asia?
Mm-hmm. Great question. I think in terms of settling down into the role, I think the hardest part for me is not seeing other leaders who look like me. You know, my peers are almost entirely men. And my peers also are almost entirely not Indonesian. So I think it's not just gender diversity, but how do we get more Indonesian representation for like, you know, product leadership where the primary market is Indonesian, right? So how do we grow that? So I think that's my biggest challenge. And I think figuring out ways to like systematically address, I think, you know, our challenges in diversity. That's been like my personal challenge and priority. And I think also priority for leadership at Gojek mm-hmm. increasingly so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you have any advice? Or tips or ideas. Yeah. Ideas is the word I'm looking for about how product leaders across Southeast Asia. So it's not just, you know, specific to mm-hmm. Gojek, but this is in general. How do we increase the diversity or get better at being inclusive at the things that we do with mm-hmm. the product? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A few things. I think the first is, I think when I think about like, what leverage do I have in this issue, right? So I think about how do we hold our leaders accountable? How do we make other leaders see that this is something that is important and something that isn't like a special issue, but like this should be business as usual, right? How do we get diversity metrics represented at company level objectives and OKRs so that we can hold teams accountable to it versus just talking about it, right? Yeah. So I think that's one. Two, I think being really mindful, I think, of unconscious biases and like just being mindful of like how some of these aren't like in your face, but might feel make underrepresented groups feel not included, or feel like they don't belong. Paying attention to that and creating, I think, community, like safe spaces for people to discuss that. So for example, I think for the product management organization, we have a couple of, you know, discussion channels where we can share a bit more freely and feel like we can support each other in that forum. And a third, it's not just hiring, but retaining people and like thinking about what do they need to feel like they're supported, right? What are like looking at metrics like promotions and growth paths for like women, right? How do we make sure that those underrepresented groups have paths and upward mobility? I would look at benefits that, you know, that specific groups might care about. For example, like parental benefits, health benefits, like Gojek health benefits in Indonesia, I think. As married women, like we get to receive benefits as a primary provider and not like a dependent, which has not always been the case. I think the default in Indonesia is that if you're a married woman, you are assumed a dependent and you don't actually automatically get like benefits. Okay. So I think we've turned that around to say like, actually, yeah, you're eligible for benefits even though you're a married woman, because you actually might be the primary, you know, provider in your household and your spouse is a dependent. So that was really important to me because my husband is a freelancer, right? Mm-hmm, and if mm-hmm. that wasn't the case, that would be something I would consider and like say like, maybe this isn't a company I want to join, right?
Yeah. So. Fantastic. Yeah. Very great. It does. And I like how, yeah, you've put it into examples as well, because that really helps contextualize the answer. One more question about your time in Gojek as well. So it was big news in Indonesia when Nadiem decided to join the government. So there was like a big change in senior leadership. It's not even senior. This is at the very top. It's not even senior. It's like the top management. How was that transition for you? And, you know, how did that change your workings with the product team, or was there no change at all actually?
I think there are some changes, and his, you know, Nadiem's presence is very much missed. I think he was often actually, he's a huge advocate and proponent of like the customer voice. He was often like that voice kind of reminding mm-hmm. us, is this good for the customer? Like why is this experience terrible? Is anybody looking at it? Like he was kind of that sponsor at the executive level. And so we were worried about that, I think, when he was departing, we talked about that, right? How do we make sure that, you know, this attention to our customer is retained and cultivated, even if Nadiem isn't there to kind of be that strongest voice in the room? But I think it was a very mindful and thoughtfully executed transition. I think Nadiem prepared like the executive team well for it, and like very slowly and mindfully kind of removed himself from like certain like forums and decision making, and inserted like other leaders in his place. And this happened over a pretty long period of time, mm-hmm. right? It didn't happen overnight. So yeah. By the time he actually exited, it felt quite smooth, at least in my perspective.
Okay. So that wasn't, I mean, it was manageable, the change in that sense for the product team.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. we come to the last part of the show, which is the song. And this is always my favorite part of the show, because I always get very perplexed Goodness. Looks and comments about, you know, why? You know, why would you put me through this? I mean, they don't say it, right? But I can see it in their eyes. So, yes, I know. And I know that, yes, I definitely put you in a spot by asking you about this. So, yes, tell us about the song that you chose.
I chose The Beatles. And I think I told you in my email, I was like, I feel like I'm just like not cool enough to share any recent songs. So I'm just going to go for a classic, you know, band.
Well, for the record, the Beatles are cool. They were cool and they still are cool now. So, you know, people who say Beatles are not cool, well, too bad. You obviously have no taste, but
I agree. But I mean, it was hard to pick a song even, right? And I feel like there's like a Beatles song for like almost any occasion. My husband and I actually walked down the aisle to a Beatles song.
Was it this particular song?
Oh God, no.
It's like, wow, this is a really, okay, not this song. Okay.
No, I think we did Here, There, and Everywhere. Okay. It was very sweet song. But I love the Beatles. He loves the Beatles. He grew up around the Beatles. I had to sneak in the Beatles because, you know, my parents did not approve. But hey, mom, good music. But this particular one, I discovered actually not till college, probably through one of my really close friends in college. And I don't know, it was probably like really late at night. And I think we were just like dancing around the dorm. And it just kind of brings back a lot of really good memories when I hear this.
Takes me back to those days. It's quite an interesting song to dance to, right? Because they're like signature time changes and tempo changes. So yeah, it's a little bit strange. Oh, by the way, I just feel like we haven't mentioned the title of the song. I think it's Happiness is a Warm Gun by the Beatles, and the link will be up here somewhere. So go take a listen, especially for any one of you who hasn't listened to the song. And especially if you don't know the Beatles, you need to question your existence in product management in Southeast Asia. Well, your existence in general. So there you go. And by the way, you're not the first person to recommend like a really old song in that sense. Well, the evergreen, right? Because I think Hendro was the one who actually he suggested a song by Frank Sinatra. So he's a Sinatra fan.
Yeah, that's really nice.
Yeah, so that's really, really good. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show. I know I've said it many, many times, and it's been really exciting and interesting conversation. So before we go, is there any product management principles or, you know, sage words of wisdom that you would like to leave with our listeners and viewers?
I don't know if I would call it sage, but this has been on my mind lately, and I think this is something that's really important to product leaders at Gojek. And this is a phrase that has stuck with us, I think, recently, is to remember that what's good for the customer is good for the business. Don't forget that.
Oh, fantastic. Lovely words. So ladies, gentlemen, boys, girls, and everyone in between of the spectrum, that was Deanne Rosanti. She's the SVP of Product Management at Gojek, and want to thank her very much for being on the show. As you can see from all our sessions, that product management in Southeast Asia is exciting, it's interesting, and it's growing, and I will be excited to bring you the next episode as soon as I can. So take care, see you, and bye-bye.